Another day of coronavirus coverage right here on Connecticut Today for Tuesday, May 5th. We talked to an economics professor from Quinnipiac University about the long-term outlook for Connecticut after the economic damage done by the virus. An author, Nick Adams, joined us about his new book comparing, he says, President Trump to Prime Minister Winston Churchill. He says there are some surprising similarities. We gave you a portion of the daily coronavirus update from Governor Ned Lamont, and we welcome back State Senator Republican Kevin Kelly from Stratford regarding what's going on at the state capitol and a special coronavirus-related event that he hosted on Facebook with the AARP. No surprise that the whole coronavirus scenario has caused some dire economic news for the state. Governor Ned Lamont and his budget people coming out last week and saying the state is running at least a $900 billion deficit for the current fiscal year, $2 billion for the next fiscal year, a total of $7 billion in red ink over the next two or three fiscal years and more. And here to discuss a return visit from Assistant Professor of Economics at Quinnipiac, Zachary Cole. Zach, Paul here in WICC, how are you?
Good, Paul, how are you?
I'm good. Well, was it any real surprise that we saw the deficit numbers that the governor rolled out last week? Or were you a little surprised it was that high or not?
Honestly, I was surprised that their projections seem rather low.
Okay. Well, do you think? Well, but you know what, Zach? If you read the fine print, they go out two or three years, and then they're saying, you know, $7 to $8 billion by year three. Is that a correct number, or do you think they're even low there?
Well, I mean, I would imagine it's rather accurate, especially when looking at how other states are projecting their financial futures to look. But I would say Connecticut, we have a lot of things going for us moving forward.
And when you say going for, it's interesting you mentioned that because I was going to ask you about pluses and minuses. So let's start with the pluses here. So what do you think is or could help the state moving forward here? Maybe an advantage or two that we have that other states don't?
We have a gigantic rainy day fund. More so than almost every other state in the United States right now. And we have kind of the flexibility to use that fund to help alleviate some of the financial cuts that we are going to end up seeing as we move forward.
So in some sense, Zachary, if you put this back to a political context here, it looks like the governor and some of the Democrats are kind of being vindicated here when they said, hey, maybe we should not look to that fund to, you know, alleviate things like transportation costs and tolls because it is a rainy day fund. And they were saying, hey, you never know what might happen. And I guess what might happen actually happened.
Yeah, I mean, this does seem like vindication for sure that this is the rainy day that they were looking towards. And it does look like they are making use of that fund now.
Now, the things that maybe are on the negative side here for the state in the next two, three, 4 years, what are the negatives here?
Well, unfortunately, we were heading towards a budget deficit before the corona lockdown started. We had essentially plateauing revenues and very rapidly increasing costs, particularly costs surrounding labor that's involved. So paying for pensions, things like this, the cost of this healthcare, it's all going up. Mm-hmm. And our revenues were kind of staying at the same level. We were taxing, but we weren't really seeing that much growth in what we were taxing. So we were already kind of teetering towards this point where the costs start outweighing the revenues that are coming into the state. And that is going to be exacerbated. So we won't really see a lot of revenues coming in. In fact, we'll see less revenue because people in the state have less income. So there's just less things to tax. And unfortunately, that's going to create interesting changes in the next 2 years.
Yeah, and the governor and Melissa McCall, you may recall last week, they said, listen, we do anticipate the tax revenues to pick up, but I was not surprised when the governor got up there and said, you know, about 30%, give or take, he said a few points, right around 30-35% of our total revenue and our total industry here in the state is basically on a timeout now. They're sitting around doing nothing, so there's no revenue being created by that. That's a huge percentage.
Yeah, actually, maybe I'm just pessimistic, but I heard that I was relieved a little. I thought it was going to be worse.
Yeah, I thought it was too, actually, when I only had, yeah, because I said to myself, well, if 70% is working, that's not too bad. But I guess, as you say, Zach, we're looking at what people refer to as legacy costs here. When we hear the term legacy costs, is that what you mean by labor and pensions and things like that?
Essentially, it includes other costs as well. But yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it.
All right, so you're sitting down with the governor, and you've got Melissa McCaw there, his budget person, OPM secretary. You've got Paul Mounds, the chief of staff. You're in the room, Zach, with all the big wigs in the state. And they say, well, Professor Cole from Quinnipiac, what do you suggest? What do you suggest that we do? What would be your top two or three things if you were advising the governor right now?
Gosh, you know, it's going to make me rather unpopular, but I think we need some type of toll structure for the traffic that's moving through the state. We put it off for a very long time in Connecticut, and I think that it's time to revisit that. And unfortunately, I hate to say it, but I think that some of the tax relief, some of the tax cuts that were scheduled, I do not think those are tenable at this point.
Yeah, I think the governor said that. Yeah, I think he said that already. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I would say I would very much caution against putting new taxes in. So an increase in the gasoline tax, an increase in income tax, an increase in sales tax, I think all of that could end up slowing down the recovery to a point that it'll be years and years before we ever see a budget surplus again. So I would caution against kind of handicapping ourselves as we begin to recover.
Are you not a big believer then in maybe sales tax adjustments? You know, one of the things that I know that came into focus before this, when we were talking knee deep in the toll thing, was saying, you know, before we get to tolls, what about another 0.5% or a 1% increase in the sales tax, and that exclusively goes to tolls and road maintenance? You think that's a bad idea or just untested?
I don't think it's a terrible idea. In this time period, I would really caution against it because we do have decreasing income all across the state. So any additional tax to our consumption is just going to slow down all of the industry when it should be picking back up.
Zach, we saw the numbers last week that 3 years out, I think they said something like $8 billion of a deficit. Now, I'm no economics whiz. I'm not an economics professor. I barely understand supply and demand. However, I think I know that $7 billion of red ink, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think I know that $7 billion of red ink is not good. Am I right on that? Can I go out on the limb and say that?
It's not great. Comparatively, it is. It's great news to me.
Really? Why would you say that?
Yeah. So, looking at the cost that the whole coronavirus pandemic has had on different areas, I mean, there are states that are talking about bankruptcy as an only possible way of escaping the financial burden. That is not even on the table for Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And in fact, multiple billion-dollar deficit is comparatively not that bad. And it's something that we can eventually catch up to. It's going to take some time, and it's going to mean that we're going to have to see some cuts in the future. But honestly, I don't think that it will be that drastic of a change to our daily lives.
When we hear politicians sometimes, even though they get shouted down, like saying, well, states should, you know, maybe it's better to declare bankruptcy. You know, sometimes, Zach, and I'm not trying to, you know, levy a response to this situation, but I think people misunderstand sometimes what bankruptcy means. it means, and correct me if I'm wrong, at a state level, that you do that oftentimes to get better terms from a lender as far as time of payback and rates of payback, correct?
Well, that's a complicated question. We don't really think that state bankruptcy is legal in the United States as outlined in the Constitution, but I think your understanding of it is about how it would work if it could happen. That's very similar to when, say, a city goes bankrupt. It allows them to renegotiate, say, with labor unions. They can renegotiate the terms of the pensions that they set up.
So you think when people like Mitch McConnell and people say that in Congress, is that because I don't think they don't want states to be able to pay their bills. Is that kind of what they're looking for to try and force these municipalities to say, hey, you dug your own hole here. Now figure out how to get out of it. Start by looking for better terms or not.
It could be. I know that when Mitch McConnell does talk about this issue, he does tend to mention pensions quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But really, the whole strategic goal of allowing states to go bankrupt just doesn't seem to be exactly clear right now.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that might not be tenable as far as the Constitution is concern. I've never really heard that mentioned. That's really interesting to me. Why? What is there something that specifically prevents it in there, or would that have to be hashed over?
Yeah, I think there is language in there within something called a contract clause that does allow subdivisions of states to kind of, you know, go into this bankruptcy, but not necessarily states. That states are rather tied to paying their debts. So whether or not it is legal, it would certainly take, you know, a look back at the Constitution. It would have to go, you know, in front of the Supreme Court. Possibly even Congress would have to amend the Constitution to allow states to reach bankruptcy.
And we all know that's not going to happen between now and the next galaxy. Finally, third quarter, let's say the economy wakes up a bit. Let's say there isn't this rumored second wave of this coronavirus infection. Is there a good chance that by late third quarter, early fourth quarter, the economic heart of the state here might be beating a little better than it is now?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I would say it's very likely that we will see a large uptick in the amount of industry that's going on. Again, it still will be a long road ahead of us, but by the end of the year, yeah, we should be moving along a little closer to what we normally look like.
From Quinnipiac University, Assistant Professor of Economics, Zachary Cole. Professor, always good to hear from you. We'll chat down the road. Take care of yourself. Thanks.
You as well. Thank you.
Our next guest, an internationally renowned speaker, commentator, lecturer, author, also runs the Foundation for Liberty and American Greatness, an organization teaching history and civics, helping inspire students on the power of the American dream. He's a contributor to numerous media outlets on various platforms. He has a new book out that is going to make, going to make the president's fans smile and critics of the president gnash their teeth probably. Trump and Churchill, Defenders of Western Civilization. Nick Adams is the guest. Nick, welcome to WICC. Thanks. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. It's a pleasure to join you and your listeners. Thank you for having me.
Well, Nick, thank you. And I would imagine that if I show this to a number of my dear friends who are a little center left, shall we say, their heads would crack and they would say, who is this Nick Adams guy and how sick is he to compare Donald Trump to Sir Winston Churchill? Do you get that about this, Nick?
Well, you know, Paul, I can understand that somebody that is so blinded by their hatred for somebody that they might feel that way. But I really believe that any objective analysis of both leaders, of both men, of the times that both were leading, we'll see that there are incredible parallels and very obvious similarities. If I were to give you a list of adjectives that would describe Winston Churchill, I think you would find that 90% of those adjectives, if not more, would also suit Donald Trump. So I don't think that the comparison is all that crazy at all, to be really honest with you, as soon as you go past the surface. I mean, of course, on the surface, Paul, there doesn't appear to be all that much commonality. One was this short guy that loved to drink. The other is a tall guy that doesn't drink at all. One liked to nap in his pajamas every afternoon. The other, it would appear, barely sleeps. One began his career by opposing tariffs, the other by introducing them. One was this soaring, compelling speaker. The other, a rather crude but very effective tweeter. But as soon as you look a little bit past all of that, you find that both were confident, loved their country, they didn't conceal their true self, they didn't conform to expectations, clear thinkers, plain speakers, alpha males, both stared down their enemies, both weren't liked by the media and didn't like the media, both endured battles with the political establishment, both followed weak leaders. Of course, Churchill had Neville Chamberlain and Donald Trump had Barack Obama. And to say that Chamberlain and Obama had the spine of a jellyfish would probably be unkind to jellyfish. So I think that that kind of magnifies the qualities, the leadership traits of both men.
More with Nick Adams, name of the book, Trump and Churchill, Defenders of Western Civilization. Nick, when Sir Winston Churchill took over as prime minister, and thankfully this is illustrated in several books, including yours, and the movie, the Gary Oldham movie from a couple of years ago. It was nice to see a historical figure in a movie that got so much acclaim. A lot of people thought, as did here in the States with Trump, a lot of people thought that Churchill might be in over his head. Did they not?
Look, you're right. I think the expectations of Sir Winston Churchill were about the same as they were for Donald Trump. Lots of people thought that Churchill was someone that was perennially wrong. He was a profoundly unserious person. His judgment was called into effect. There was a plethora of different feelings about it. But ultimately, both Churchill and I think now what we're seeing with Donald Trump were able to overcome all of those anxieties that lots of different people had. And history ended up judging Churchill very favorably. And I suspect history will judge Donald Trump favorably as well.
Does that come, Nick, from a semblance or a sense that you get of what people consider normal, the political class? Was Churchill trying to upend, as Trump sold himself a bit, as somebody who was not of the class that got us into this? Was that part of the success of Churchill?
It most certainly was. It most certainly was, Paul. I mean, before any of the World War II events happened, Winston Churchill was delivering a very different and extremely unpopular message. In 1933, he gave a speech where he spoke about Britain's difficulties arising from the mood of unwarrantable self-abasement into which we have been cast by a powerful selection of our own intellectuals. These defeatist doctrines, he went on, had been accepted by a large proportion of politicians. And then he went on to ask, but what have they to offer but a vague internationalism, a squalid materialism, and the promise of impossible utopias? So without a doubt, I mean, he was singing a different tune. He was ringing a completely different bell to all of the politicians at the time. And he was very much against the prevailing sentiment that the elites, cultural, political, and social had at the time.
what was in his background, Nick, that made him that way? Donald Trump always talks about, and his sons talk about, being a blue-collar billionaire, a guy that could talk to somebody on a construction site in New York. Was there anything in Churchill's background that made him connect with people like that?
No, not really. Churchill was you know, born into a wealthy family and had very aristocratic upbringing. But I think what Churchill and Trump had in common is there is this very strong sense of individualism. And what I mean by that is they really go out of their way to be different. They go out of their way to not fit the mold. They go out of their way to color outside of the lines. And so they had this personality. Churchill had this personality that he developed over time, and he kind of stuck with that, and that was totally out of the realm of what everyone else was doing. And for that reason, I guess, he had this ability to connect with people. That was really more so a personality thing and an individualism thing, as opposed to part of his upbringing, I think.
And do you think part of that was that Nick Adams, you know, Winston Churchill was not the most, you know, telegenic guy. He had that lisp. He had that kind of raspy voice to go along with the lisp. And as the great American reporter Ed Murrow once said, every newborn baby looks like Winston Churchill. Was that part of his appeal, you think?
I think so. He certainly was an Instagram ready, to use a term that we might use today. I think that did kind of appeal to people. He was someone that they could relate to. He drank a little bit too much on occasion. He suffered from gout. He ate too much. I mean, and these are all things that made him very human, and I do think made him very relatable to the people. And that's something that, for whatever reason, has been lost, I think, in today's political era. You know, you're meant to look good as a politician, as a public figure. You're meant to look good. You're meant to, you know, be kind of look like you come out of a picture frame at the store. So I do think that all of those things humanized Churchill, and people were able to find a resonance with him because of that.
There are people, Nick Adams, to this day who say, even as we head into this election season, that there may be forces as deep inside as the White House and in the intelligence community, in the State Department, who would love to do nothing else and see Donald Trump defeated and to go back to what they term as normalcy. Was Churchill facing any of that himself during his time as prime minister?
Look, there certainly was. There was a swamp in Churchill's day. There were people that were actively working against him. What got Churchill through is, I guess, the same thing that gets Donald Trump through, which is their incredible will to win. But in my new book, Trump and Churchill, Paul, we produce passages from British national newspapers written in the mid to late 1930s and early 1940s. And if I didn't tell you that those passages were from British national newspapers referring to Winston Churchill, you would think that they were excerpts from the New York Times or the Washington Post about Donald Trump. So identical is the criticism, so similar are the accusations that that are leveled. So they both fought the media, they both fought the establishment, they both fought people within the government that didn't like their agenda, that were offended by their audacity to be different, to think differently, to not conform, to not do what the prevailing sentiment had been over the last 15 years prior to them coming into office. And they were resented for that, and they tried to thwart their agenda because of that. But ultimately, again, their passion won through.
Nick Adams, you include in the title there, Defenders of Western Civilization. Mr. Trump and Mr. Churchill were both very adamant about that when referring to forces that they felt were deleterious to their respective nations. And because of that, they are both, Mr. Churchill was, and Mr. Trump is to this day, both branded with the racism badge by many people. Get into that a little bit, if you can, with me during the Churchill time. In reading about him by columnists today, they still cite certain things he did or said and say, hey, he was a veiled racist. What's your reaction to that?
Well, look, I mean, I don't think that anybody, again, being objective or reasonable or fair, Paul, would conclude that either Donald Trump or Winston Churchill are racist men, were racist men. They're patriots. They love their country. They'll stop at nothing to protect their country and to protect their country's values and civilization's values. And that's why, unfortunately, they get labelled racist by their enemies and critics and detractors. Winston Churchill gets the rap because he wrote very candidly as a young man in the 1890s, actually, about Islam and very unvarnished kind of view of what Islam was and how we should be careful of it. And that kind of drew the ire of a lot of people. But Churchill was no racist. His mother was an American, so he was half American. And he was a guy of the West. I mean, he loved the United States of America. He loved the English-speaking people. But that didn't make him. He did put Britain first. But that doesn't make him racist. And the same way Donald Trump puts America first, says that we should buy American, hire American, that we should bring jobs back to America. But none of that is any evidence that they don't like other people or other places. And in Donald Trump's case, America is not a race to begin with anyway. It's an idea.
How do you compare both men, Mr. Trump and Mr. Churchill, Nick Adams, into their dealings with foreign governments and foreign powers and maybe governments that were not as kind to the respective countries?
Well, they're both very blunt people. They really just gave it to anyone that would listen. Sometimes that happened to be leaders of foreign governments. But like I say, they prioritized for their people, they prioritized their country, they prioritized the best possible outcome they could achieve for their people. And they didn't mess around. They didn't kind of, hit foreign leaders over the head with a cabbage leaf. I mean, they set out to go and get the best possible outcome they could. And in doing that, they were very direct, very aggressive. There's a reason why Winston Churchill is referred to as the British bulldog. Both men are bulldogs that are just out there ready to succeed, ready to dominate.
And finally, Nick, the numbers people and looking at what happened with Donald Trump's election in 2016, they all talk about kind of a hidden Trump vote. People ended up voting for him who wouldn't really tell the pollsters. It may happen again this coming November. Who knows? Do you think in retrospect there was a portion of the British electorate when Mr. Churchill was elected that voted for him but wouldn't have been honest with it if there had been widespread public opinion polling back in that day?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think that goes without saying. It's always hard to know when there isn't any polling evidence, but I think that it's pretty clear that tends to be human nature, that when someone is slightly controversial, when somebody is kind of outside of the pack and you plan on supporting that person, particularly in a society like England where it's a much more collectivist society, I think people would have been very reluctant to share their supportive views of Winston Churchill. And in the same way, I think, you know, a lot of American people feel that the pollsters that are ringing them are from the coast and their elites themselves, and the last thing they're going to do is tell these pollsters the truth and tell them, you know, who they're going to vote for. So I think there was a lot of that. I think there is a lot of that, without a doubt.
It'll be released actually 2 weeks from today. So today being the 5th, 2 weeks from today, May 19th, 2020. It's called Trump and Churchill, Defenders of Western Civilization. Pre-order it on Amazon, wherever you get your books. Pick it up, even if you're not a Trump fan. You should read this. It's a fascinating comparison between two very interesting leaders. And we thank Nick Adams, the author, for stopping by. Nick, thank you, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Paul. It was a pleasure.
A little bit. Remember, we've had a good downward trend. I think it was 8 days. One day is not something really to focus on, but it's just to keep in mind that this is by no means behind us. And we did do a fair number of tests, 3,300. And at least the infection rate amongst the positive cases was pretty low. You can see on the next slide the day-to-day change in hospitalizations. You can see what the downward trend was there, and with one outlier. But we watch this carefully, because COVID is highly infectious, and there's not a lot of a margin for error. And you probably saw the President of the United States when he sat at Abraham Lincoln's statue at the Lincoln Memorial, where he said, I thought we were going to anticipate 60,000 fatalities, and now it looks like it could be closer to 120,000 fatalities. And that just reminds us that we better be very cautious as we plan going forward. And that's what we're trying to be. And you know about our May 20 date. You know that we're going to be able to outline some more of the protocols in terms of how businesses on a limited basis can start opening on May 20th. We're going to give you what those protocols are. But it's worth reminding that we're looking at the facts on the ground every day and make sure what we're doing is safe for you. You know, yesterday, the governor's residence was pretty busy. We had dozens of cars driving around in circles, beeping horns, shouting, give me liberty or give me death. Everybody was polite and socially distanced, I appreciate. But I was thinking, give me liberty or give me death. I mean, you know, we can all be libertarians, and you should be free to be dumb if you want to, but not if it endangers others. And that's what is so deadly about COVID, that you're not just endangering yourself, but by being lax and not taking the social distancing seriously, endangers everybody else. And when you wear a mask, it's not necessarily to protect yourself. It's to protect everybody about you. It's a different way of thinking what your obligations are. And that's why I continue to be strict about this and urge you to maintain the social distancing, because that's how we get this state going again. And that's how we keep to our May 20 date and beyond. You know, with that, as you probably heard, Miguel and I had to announce that the school year in terms of classroom learning, will not open up in this next cycle. It'll not open up before June 30, not open up until the fall, although we'll be able to talk about summer school and summer camps. Look, it breaks my heart. I mean, we were pretty early on in terms of a lot of the social distancing and protocols we put into place. I wanted to do everything I could to find some way to keep the school year at least partially open just for a couple weeks, some sense of conclusion for our students. But Miguel has been informed by superintendents and parents and teachers across the board. We see a continuing increase in infections in many regions of the state, and this was no time to take that risk. So sadly, in terms of traditional classroom education, that will not continue in this school year. That said, I want you to know that we're going to maintain education in a virtual sense. I mean, I ran for governor. I wanted to be the education governor. I thought this was the most important thing we could do. I thought the quality of our K through 12, the quality of our colleges, the amazing workforce we had positioned us for the 21st century, and that was going to be my priority. Now I'm the guy that has to say we're not going to continue the school year in this cycle. That said, Miguel has been really good. We've taken the lead in terms of online learning, distance learning. Chart here you can see those who can teach, those who can't teach virtually. Thank you, Glastonbury teachers. I thought that sign said it all, and that's what we're really trying to do right now. We have, tens of thousands of reading materials from Scholastic being distributed to our schools across the state last week and this week. Bridgeport Early Childhood Education, Bristol, Hartford, Norwalk, making sure that those kids continue to learn. We're streaming the Scholastic content right now. Our teachers are amazing. They're stepping up. They're doing telephone classes. They're doing Zoom classes, online classes. And I think we've been pleasantly surprised, haven't we, Miguel, that I think most kids are taking to this. Maybe a guy my age, it seems a little not the way I'm used to, but for these kids, they are, and they are continuing to learn. And one of the things we're going to be describing to you today is how they're going to continue to learn this summer so we can help to bring people up to speed. Miguel Cardona was telling me that he's got a center where people can send in comments, and we've had over 30,000 folks weigh in, teachers, parents, like I said, superintendents, everybody in terms of, you know, because education involves us all, and the passions were deep. I think the feeling was, pretty strong that this is not the time to risk sending kids back into a classroom. A classroom is not a natural place for social distancing. A classroom is a place where people gather. And we're weighing that as we go forward into this new school year. Tomorrow, I should tell you that we're going to have our college and university team come in and tell you what we're thinking about in terms of the colleges and universities. But first, I think I'd like just to have Miguel Cardona give you a little bit of our thinking about this current school year and what we do going forward. And then a Beth Bai, a follow-on, in particular with what we've done on daycares to date and going forward, and in particular our summer camps as we try and keep our kids involved. Miguel?
Thank you. Thank you, Governor. And I'm glad to be here with Commissioner Bai as well. As you stated, class cancellation until further notice is difficult to accept for all of us, but one based on the decision of health and safety of our students, our families, and our staff. As one former student put it, it's not surprising, but it is devastating. For the students listening, your school year has not ended. Your teacher, school, and district leaders and staff are committed to supporting your learning for the remainder of the school year. While we know it's not the same, on this Teacher Appreciation Day, I want to acknowledge all the educators that have given tirelessly to their students while tending to their families and caring for their loved ones. Thank you. To the fifth graders, eighth graders, and adult education students whose promotion ceremonies will not be typical, congratulations on your upcoming huge accomplishment. The governor and I are proud of you. Seniors, as I shared last month, your high school and district leaders have been working hard with your input, trying to find a safe and appropriate way to honor your accomplishment. You worked hard and deserve to be honored. I think of seniors that I know, like Kyle, Mia, Angel Lee, and the impact it's having on them. Students like Millen and Sophia, who serve on our board, my heart goes out to you. You worked hard and deserve all the praise you're going to get. Congratulations to those of you that are going on to college, career, armed forces, and those of you that are staying in their community to make it better. We have over a month left of classes. Let's finish strong, Connecticut. While this decision to cancel is not welcomed by students, parents, or educators, we know that we have to continue to look at this as a safety issue. Further guidance on summer school will be provided later this month, with an emphasis on those students who may have additional learning needs. With proper social distancing and improving trends, the Connecticut Education Committee of the Reopen Task Force hopes to be able to provide summer school options in July. We are actively planning what a safe reentry would look like and are eager to open up our buildings once again. To do this, with the help of our REST, we're getting input from thousands of students, parents, educators, and community partners. Schools serve as communities of growth for our students, not only academically, but socially and emotionally. And we look forward to welcoming you back in a safe way. Thank you, Governor.
So, Beth, how are we looking for summer camps? Unmute, please.
Thank you, Governor, for your leadership. And Miguel, it's been great to work with you and collaborate with you on the education subcommittee. Your comments are so important to so many families out there. The governor mentioned childcare. I'll just mention that childcare does remain open in Connecticut. Some programs have closed the majority of centers, but some have remained open to serve those critical frontline workers in our state. And we're so grateful for their service. The governor asked me here today to talk to you about summer camps. Those that are licensed are regulated by the Office of Early Childhood, and there are also some operated by cities and schools. And so the rules that we are designing for camps will apply to all summer programming for children. I think the governor, Commissioner Cardona, and I all understand this has been a challenging time for families across Connecticut, and we're hoping for some return to normalcy for children and families, knowing that summer camps can open for their children in an environment subject to coronavirus prevention guidance. The decision of the Reopen Connecticut team, OEC, and the State Department of Ed was that summer camps can open on June 29th. That gives more time. And they will also have very specific guidance. Currently, there are about 5 camps that have opened to provide childcare to critical workers, and those can remain open as part of the childcare infrastructure. Other camps can open beginning June 29th. Working with Reopen, we've developed guidelines to assure added protective measures to reduce the likelihood of exposure to the virus for children and families. The camps that I've been in touch with at OEC, we developed a memo that's Memo 18 on our website where you can look for guidance. Much of that will remain, and there will be some additional guidance that will be released by May 15th. Right now, you know, camps are making decisions about whether to open or not. That's up to them, much like childcare programs made decisions whether to remain open or not. And families are also making those decisions now about what are my summer plans for my children. So know that the governor has announced today that camps will not need to close, but they will need to live with some very specific public health guidance that we've worked out with Reopen Connecticut and the health team and with the Office of Early Childhood. So by May 15th, those will be released with all the specifics. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Beth. And we're here to take questions, and Josh Jabal is here as well.
News 12 Connecticut.
Hi, Governor. The CEA, the teachers union, is calling for some very specific guidelines to reopen schools in the fall, including PPE for everyone, staggered school start times. A lot of the superintendents we've talked to today said those are great, but those are going to be very expensive, and some of our districts are already slashing budgets. What can you tell them about what kind of assistance the state is going to provide them to make those things happen?
Well, Miguel is working with a great task force that includes Don Williams from CEA, includes teachers, includes parents, includes superintendents, looking at the facts on the ground. And we'll figure out over the course of the next month or two what the fall looks like, if that's what we're talking about now. What are going to be the requirements? What are going to be the class sizes? What are going to be the masks and the such? I think it's too early to make those predictions right now, but we're going to give our school boards plenty of notice.
Is the state prepared to offer them additional money, though, to make that happen?
Well, we'll have to take a look at that in terms of what the requirements are there. We are getting some federal support for the schools as well. Isn't that right, Miguel?
It is right. Yeah, the CARES Act funding, which we applied for and we submitted the application yesterday, should provide some additional funds to support student needs.
NBC Connecticut.
Governor Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. Was hoping to get a little more clarification about graduation for the high school seniors. Are you able to say if in-person graduations will be allowed or not? There was that petition going around for a statewide graduation to take place.
Miguel, do you want to start with that?
Sure, thank you. You know, we know graduations are such an important part of the experience. Especially for our seniors, we want to make sure that they're acknowledged for the 13 years of hard work. So we have been in communication. If you recall last month when I was on with the governor, we asked superintendents to give consideration to what graduation looks like. And I'm really pleased to say that these districts have not slowed down planning, having backup plans, and student input when making decisions about what graduations are going to look like. Districts are planning graduations with input from students, but also ensuring that they're following executive orders from the governor.
Hey, Matt, I can be a little more direct. I mean, while obviously our recommendation is probably a virtual graduation is the best way to go, and we don't see any in-person graduations this June, if I had to make an estimate right now. I think we're still looking at what happens later and seeing if you can have an outside graduation with the appropriate social distancing, and I think a determination on that will be made at a later time.
News 8.
For Commissioner Bai, I know it's not the state's job to find daycare for people, but do you have any guidelines or suggestions on what to do as the state opens back up, people are heading back to work, and the kids aren't in school?
Unmute.
Yes, I appreciate that question. It gives me a chance to highlight that indeed we do have a system in place to help families find childcare, and it's been pretty effective through the coronavirus emergency. Parents can call 211 childcare and ask for childcare near their home or near their work, and they keep track every week, and we are tracking every week where the open spaces are. And we've been doing a lot to support the supply that exists of childcare and not lose additional supply. So we know there's still some supply, and families can call 211 childcare. We also have a program for frontline workers that's open now that gives them a $200 subsidy a week to help them pay those childcare costs, because we know they're having to make additional arrangements if their programs are closed, and they can also enroll in that by calling 211 childcare.
WTIC 1080 News.
Good afternoon. On the 60,000 laptops, did most of them make it, or are they going to make it? And is that something that could last into the fall with the distance learning?
They are going to start being delivered, I think, in the next couple of weeks. You're right, it's going to be phased in over a period of time, going to those commissioner districts, and it's going to be integral to our ongoing learning. My hunch is going forward, you're going to see a lot more online learning to complement what's going on in the classroom.
And I'm just being asked by somebody I work with about the one class, one graduation concept. I guess that would be a plan for smaller ceremonies. Have you heard of that?
I have. What I've heard from the reopen committee is the idea of doing one big thing on the same day across the state is probably not the right way to go. They've reserved the option to say maybe we can have some outside graduations later on in the year, depending on the facts on the ground.
A couple minutes now with our old buddy, State Senator, Republican Kevin Kelly of Stratford, is going to tell us about an event coming up tomorrow that area seniors may be interested in. Kevin, how are you? How are you holding up during all this?
Hey, Paul, pretty well. And okay. Before we even get started, I'd just like to wish you and all your listeners a happy Cinco de Mayo.
That's right. Behave yourself, though, Kevin. You got to behave yourself. You know. Yes.
Well, you can always behave as an Irishman, right?
I'm sure you are. See, I wouldn't know that. My name ends in a vowel, so I'm going to wash my hand. I'm going to pull a Pontius Pilate with that here, Kevin. Kevin, you gave me the high sign here, and then I wanted to have you on for a few minutes to chat about something I know that you think would help seniors that's coming up tomorrow night. What do you have for us?
Well, we have a Facebook Live with a guest, Nora Duncan, who is the state AARP president, director. And she's done this a number of times and will help to educate individuals on what AARP resources available, both for seniors and caregivers, so that if they have questions, they'll know where to go to get some of the answers. And also just to bring forward the message that as much as we need to keep our social distance, it's not does not mean social isolation. And there are friends, family, neighbors among us who are seniors and don't have the luxury to get out either to the market or elsewhere in the community, or people who are actually shut in nursing homes and assisted living facilities where they aren't even allowed to leave their room. And these are very frightening times if you're in that situation, and a little call here or there. Maybe have either a telephone call or a FaceTime with your loved one is the difference between making a great day and a not so great day.
So how would they? How would somebody be able to see this? Maybe participate in this, Kevin. What's the link for it?
Well, go to my Kevin Kelly the Kevin Kelly State Senator Kevin Kelly Facebook page.
Yeah,
and there will be a link there.
Okay.
It starts tomorrow at 5 o'clock. It'll run from like 5 to 5:30.
Great.
It will take questions if anybody has questions, and maybe go a couple extra, half hour, 45 minutes. But I think that would be a great opportunity for, like I say, seniors and caregivers to get some information.
Sure. And Kevin, along those lines, if I can ask you, and I know obviously you're up on this because you're an elder law attorney. One of the stories that's coming out here, Kevin, that's kind of we're getting the details in dribs and drabs here, is the fatality rate with COVID-19 in state nursing homes. And I know the state had a plan earlier to do COVID-19 homes, positive and negative homes. I would hope that that's something that you folks in the General Assembly and health experts will really try and focus on once the dust kind of clears from this whole thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, clearly, Paul, the death rate among our senior population is significant. It's almost breathtaking. And that's why there was a big social push for the social distancing, because there are segments of our population. Seniors happen to be one of them. There are many across the varying age groups that are more prone and susceptible to COVID. And so we are seeing this in nursing homes, assisted living facilities, senior housing and congregate facilities. And it's something that, as a member of the aging committee, I will certainly be looking into, what happened. Did the state do enough? And more importantly, how do we avoid this if indeed we do have a resurgence in the fall and we don't have a vaccine or any protection against the virus? What is the state doing now to make sure that when that happens, that we aren't in the same situation? Because the death rate is astounding, and it's very difficult because many of these individuals, if not all of them, are passing by themselves. They don't have the opportunity to have a family or loved one to hold their hands, to be with them at this time. And so it's very lonely and frightening, and it's just not a great experience. And that's why, like I said at the outset, just a call from a friend or a family member into somebody in that situation, just to let them know that you're thinking about them, really goes a long way for these individuals.
Kevin, thank you. And once again, it's your Facebook page, State Senator Kevin Kelly, and there'll be a link for it tomorrow starting at 5 with Nora Duncan, a chat where folks can ask questions. Nora, the State Director for AARP. Kevin, thanks. We'll be in touch. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. Take care.